the Speaker, I can tell you that both initiatives will deliver more than what that last government attempted to when, for instance, they put out a $1 billion infrastructure scheme.
Yeah, tēnā koutou, I'm Selwyn Manning and welcome to A View From Afar. And today we are joined by political scientist Paul Buchanan, and in this episode we will discuss whether sanctions will be effective in deterring Russian President Vladimir Putin from a full invasion of Ukraine and indeed cause Russian military to return to the Russian side of the Ukraine border. Also, what we will discuss is whether or not the Russian Federation now has a momentum and the support of a coalition of authoritarian governments that will render the West's sanctions ineffective. And the question then follows, are we witnessing the advent of what we will call the progression of global bipolarity? But before we deep dive into these issues, remember, if you are joining us live via the social media platforms, feel free to comment, as we can include your interaction and your questions in this program. So let's cross to Paul Buchanan, who's waiting online to discuss these and other deep dive issues. Tēnā koe, Paul. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Selwyn.
It's good to see you. Now, this is a deep dive, as we call this particular type of episode, where we're going to go deeper into the theoretical and actually apply that to current events that are happening. And in this episode's case, up in the Russia-Ukraine border areas, and of course, the geopolitical juxtapositionings that have been going on over the last 2 weeks in particular. Paul, before we do, I'll just bring up what Germany's Deutsche Welle media organisation put out late yesterday, New Zealand time, relating to sanctions. But significantly, if we just look here, the Germany halts the Nord Stream. Now, it's Chancellor Scholz is speaking to this point, and we'll come back and dig into the issues of sanctions as we return from this.
We have agreed a first set of sanctions, and over the course of the day, we will conclude these together. I said earlier that the situation we find ourselves in today is a completely different one than it was. Thus, due to the latest developments, we need to assess the situation, not least when it comes to Nord Stream 2. I have asked the German Ministry of the Economy to give us the report that it has on the energy supply for the grid authority so that there's no certification of the pipeline possible. Now, this sounds a bit technical, but without this certification, Nord Stream 2 cannot go online. The Department of the German Ministry of Economics will reassess the security of our supply needs in light of what has taken place in the last day or two. In this phase, it is important, apart from initial sanctions, to prevent a further escalation and with it a disaster. All of our diplomatic efforts will be aimed at achieving this. These are very difficult days and hours for Europe. 80 years after the end of the Second World War, it would seem that a war is threatening us in Eastern Europe. It is our job to mitigate this disaster, and I appeal to Russia once again to help us in this process. Thank you.
So that was Germany's Chancellor Scholz there, and he was speaking in a statement, obviously, to global media, but in this case we were streaming from Deutsche Welle in Germany. Paul, what do you make of the current situation? What do you assess is Vladimir Putin, the Russian president's position with respect to where he goes from here? And I'm saying that with framing that through the response of the West through this, through its actions toward sanctions and a phase one of sanctions.
Well, I mean, you know, the events have unfolded more or less as you and I forecast them to. He's now done a limited territorial incursion with his peacekeepers. And I should point out before I discuss, you know, his reaction to sanctions. So they're a very brief history lesson. I thought his speech was interesting because it appeared to be more for domestic consumption than for an international audience. And the reason I say that is, remarkably, he didn't speak about the Soviet Union. See, he was harking to a historical past, claiming that Ukraine has always been part of Russia. He mentioned the Baltics. We talked about this a little bit last week. But the speech was interesting because what he was harking to was the Russian Empire, even pre-Tsarist Russia. And the Russian Empire extended from the southern and eastern banks of the Baltic Sea all the way to the Bering Strait, included all of what are now known as the Stans and most of northwestern China, included the Ukraine, included all the Baltic states that we have talked about, included a whole lot of them, and half of Poland. Now, that historical claim that he has the right to recapture territories that were lost over the centuries may be legitimate in the eyes of the domestic population. I mean, he's really pushing that line very hard. It's a very dangerous precedent in a post-colonial world, you know, a post-empire world. And I would urge our listeners to see the five-minute talk that the Kenyan ambassador to the UN gave to the UN Security Council. Kenya is a temporary member of the Security Council, in which he talked about the African experience with post-empire nationhood. And basically what he said is, given our history of colonialism, exploitation, and oppression, where Europeans carved us up without regard to ethnic, religious, or tribal traditional lines, if we were to try to go back and reclaim things based on the ancient past, we'd be in a state of perpetual war. And so I thought it was a brilliant summary of why this sort of, you know, it isn't revisionist. I mean, the Russian Empire was what the Russian Empire was.
And also now, Putin was talking specifically as well. He kept underscoring, if you want to put it that way, the Soviet Union, the Union of Soviet Socialist Republics, and all of the republics that it had within, if we want to put it this way, and within its empire. And it seemed that he was critiquing what had happened after 1991, 1992, where the Russian Federation emerged out of it, where, of course, Ukraine and others became self-determining as governments. He said at that point he wasn't going to name people and be critical of what they did, but he was critical of the events of what had occurred. So this is something that it seems that Vladimir Putin is definitely driving out there, doesn't it? In the sense that he is saying, this is basically what we consider to be the rightful land, territorial space of the Russian Federation as we move through the 2020 decade. Now, from that, Paul, do you think that he is doing that thing where you push an idea out so far that if you contain, you come back to something that is satisfactory? Or do you think that this is basically what he wants to do?
No, I think it's the former. You know, I think that he's well aware that he can't reclaim the past glory of either the Russian Empire or the Soviet Union. And I should point out that when I say he really didn't mention the Soviet Union, he didn't mention it as a political entity. You know, he was referring to the fact that it was constituted by all these, you know, departments and regions that historically, you know, he believes, the Russians may believe, belong to them. Yep. Now, with regards to the move he's made, the move follows what we predicted. I mean, we're not, you know, crystal ball gazers, but contrary to a lot of the Western press, you know, we talked last week and we've talked previously that he's going to make a limited territorial move into areas that are occupied by pro-Russian separatists. That he has done, and he's paused. And he's paused for a reason. He wants to test how the sanctions regime is going to evolve.
It's almost now, like he's doing a boa constrictor type of maneuver on Ukraine. Anyway, when we look at it from the Ukrainian point of view, you can see, like we addressed and I've brought up on screen for those that are watching the video as opposed to listening to it, the map that comes from the CSIS, which is the Centre of Strategic International Studies. And we can see the locations of all of the Russian military all around the perimeter. What Vladimir Putin has done and ordered now is in that Donetsk and Donbas region, for example, in particular, moving the troops into that space. So just from the point of view of perpetuity reasons, that's where we are on the historical timeline right now, that those areas in Crimea, of course, are have Russian troops inside, and there is shelling taking place in the last 48 hours between Ukrainian military forces and the separatists, and now also it could escalate into responses from the Russian military. Is that's fair, isn't it, Paul? I just wanted to underscore where we were on the timeline right now.
Yeah, we're in the first phase where he's come in and he's now forward staging in the separatist regions, but he's not going to stop there. The key for those who are looking at the map, the key are the blue and the purple lines. I happen to believe that the green lines, which are Russian troop movements coming out of Belarus, will be held in reserve in the event of more generalized resistance and a refusal of the West to accede to the Russian demands. But they're going to be held in reserve. They're not going to be used in the first instance. The Russians want to do this. They've paused just to see the initial response of the West. You have to remember that for a sanctions regime of any magnitude, much less this magnitude, it's going to have to have near universal compliance. I mean, so Nord Stream 2 has now been delayed or has been canceled. But what happens if OPEC members assist the Russians in circumventing the loss of revenues that would have been accrued by the opening of the Nord Stream 2? What happens if the Chinese agree to buy the surplus fuel and store it in their strategic reserves? I mean, if the sanctions regime is circumvented, then he'll know that the Western response is at best a paper tiger.
Well, this seems to be one of the things, doesn't it? And this is right in key with the question that we're examining today. It speaks right to that point. Are we seeing the advent of a bipolarized world? Bipolarity being the term, perhaps, Paul, that you may correct me on that, but where you've got global order structured around two leading powers. If we look at the West, we can identify where the West is positioning on this with the sanctions. And like we discussed last week, the People's Republic of China and the Russian Federation are the two leaders, signed an agreement relating to Russia providing gas to the People's Republic of China. And we know that its development needs, meaning the PRC, is extraordinarily huge. So it's almost like it may be early, but it's almost like saying, well, we don't need Western Europe on our, meaning the Russians don't need Western Europe to pay their bills in that scenario.
Yeah, I mean, this first round, I mean, he just wants to see what the effectiveness of the first round of sanctions is. I mean, they're going to have to cut off all Russian financial institutions from credit emanating from the West. I mean, we've seen
the sovereign debt issues relating to the Russian economy. That's where the United States is making a move on, and significantly the Germans coming through with cancelling Nord 2. So it cuts off that gas, you know, the future gas pipelines to Western Europe in that way, and then Germany and others assess their energy requirements from alternative sources. So that's where we are right at this minute, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, I guess it's fortuitous that we're going into spring. Mm. And so the cost to the Russians in terms of profits may be greater than the cost to the Europeans of their energy needs. I mean, if this was going into winter, the Russians would have a lot more leverage. But even so, the energy exports are only a bit of the equation. You've got to cut off the Russians entirely. You've got to cut them out of the international financial system. This bit about, you know, individuals, oligarchs, Putin himself, having their assets frozen, that's a drop in the bucket. I mean, if you're going to get serious, you need almost universal conformity with the sanctions regime. And it has to be across the board. And that's why he's paused, because he's just going to look out there and see what the impact is on his local economy, on his own economy. Now, I don't think he's going to stop with declaring the separatist regions independent. He's going to take the entirety of the Donetsk and Luhansk regions of the Donbass. So you can see the two cities, you can see all of that will be taken, because not all of the Donbass region is controlled by separatists, but he's going to take it all. The blue lines pretty much tell you. He's also, as you can see with the purple lines, he's going to push out of the Crimea. And that, this brings up an interesting point. He had three specific demands last night in a follow-up speech. One, that Crimea and Sevastopol be recognized as Russian territory. Two, that Ukraine never join NATO. And three, that Ukraine not be militarized. In other words, he wants to de-weaponize the Ukraine. So that buffer within a buffer theory that we had last week is now starting to come true. Blood will be shed as he moves out of these separatist regions. There will be a war. And I think he's prepared for that. I think he's going to go to that, because he'll see that the sanctions regime is not enough, that they can't stop him in the separatist regions. So he's going to push forward, and he's going to do more or less what you and I talked about last week. He's going to push up to the Dnieper River. And by the way, in the Russian Empire, there was a vast region known as the Dnieper Ukraine, which included the central plains of Ukraine, extended well into what is now Western Ukraine, and included Kiev. So again, these traditional claims on the Ukraine are true. I mean, this used to be part of Russia. Now, again, the relevance to the 21st century can be debated amongst the Russians themselves. You know, the rest of us have no doubt that Ukraine should remain independent. But he's going to push out of these separatist regions. He's going to gain control of the land routes into the Crimea. And I remain convinced that he's going to get what he wants, because the sanction regime will fail. And it has to do with that circumvention. Let me, before we get into the bipolarity, let's look at who supports the Russians right now. Starting from my own hemisphere, Venezuela, Nicaragua, and Cuba, of course. Syria, of course. All of the stands, of course. China, of course. Libya, one government supports the Russians, the Western-backed government supports the West. Iran has sort of remained silent on this, but even their neutrality tells you a lot. And there was one other place that was, Pakistan. Right now, the Pakistani prime minister is in Moscow visiting with Putin and will not say anything critical of the move. So he's got some backing. And if any of those countries help the Russians circumvent the sanctions regime, which they can, then if that regime starts to falter, think of it this way, Selwyn. How can I put this politely with relevance to New Zealand? In New Zealand, there's a lot of talk about Chinese influence operations. We have talked about it. But the dirty little secret in New Zealand is that it is New Zealanders who facilitate these influence operations. Former prime ministers, very influential, mostly white New Zealanders, who are the useful fools for the Chinese project. Well, let's think of all the business interests tied to Russia in places like the UK, throughout Europe. People whose material interests depend on them toadying up to the Russians in a time of crisis, because their business interests are integrally linked.
And even private schools, for example, in the UK.
Exactly, exactly.
Yeah.
So
to put it politely.
The boat builders, the private jet builders, I mean, we can be facetious, but the point is, your sanctions regime would have to cover all of them, either coercively or compensate them for the loss of the economic losses accrued because of the sanctions. And I'm not sure that's going to happen. I think there's going to be a lot of agitation within the West to lift the sanctions regime as sooner rather than later, regardless of what Putin does. We already see in the United States the conservative side of the ledger, and in particular the Republican Party, fracturing over how to respond. I mean, Trump called Putin a genius.
Yeah, he said the move, yes, over the last 2 days, last 48 hours, was pure genius, I think was Trump's words, wasn't it?
Yeah, and many of his followers in the media, in the Republican Party, have parroted that line, much to the dismay of security conservatives in the Republican Party. And so I think that's a microcosmic example or representation of how the West is going to react. It's not going to react in a uniform, homogeneous, and coherent fashion. There will be all sorts of divisions and people trying to carve out space regardless of what Putin does. And that gives him the green light to continue his advance. He will have to kill Ukrainians in order to establish his hold on Eastern Ukraine. But then he'll do what, as it turns out, we were prescient about talking about that. He's going to do what he's done in Georgia. He's going to recognize Eastern Ukraine as an independent state or a collection of independent states, autonomous from Russia, but under the security mantle of the Russian Federation. They'll become part of that federation, I would imagine, over time. But he's done this before, and he's going to do it again. And you alluded to the moderate militant strategy a few minutes ago, and I thought that's excellent, because in the first speech, where he said he was going in to the Ukraine, he mentioned the Baltic states, and I think, and that sent a shiver up my spine, because I'm like, now you're talking about a much bigger war, because the Estonians, the Slovakians, the Lithuanians, the Latvians, they don't want a bar of Russia. But you know what? I think he did that to put out what we would call a militant demand. I want all of the Baltics back. And he really doesn't. What he wants is to have his so-called moderate demand to lay claim to Eastern Ukraine. And he'll be satisfied with that. And I don't think the sanctions regime is going to protect him from, discourage him from continuing this advance. I truly, and here's something that I have to say, because it really bothers me. Unfortunately, particularly the United States and its media have now decided to take a page out of the Russian book. And they're pushing disinformation. It's as if the Biden administration has decided if you can't beat them, you might as well join them when it comes to pushing propaganda and disinformation out onto the world stage. Why? Because they keep on talking about a full invasion and occupation of the Ukraine. And from the government, the highest government level, Biden said it, his spokesman say it, but every media mouthpiece in the United States talks about the full invasion of the Ukraine. Why would he do that? There is no rational reason for him to go beyond the Dnieper River. None. There's no strategic value.
I pick up the logic that you're talking about there, Paul, because if, and it does seem to be the case, that what Putin is seeking is that buffer zone between the Western Europe and Eastern Europe. Now, if he goes and takes the whole of Ukraine, he's got a very thin blue line there of Western troops, NATO countries, right on that border, which he doesn't actually have right at the moment. So I pick up the logic of what you were saying. Those areas of which contain inside of Ukraine Russian cultures, Russian-speaking population in part, seem to be the limit of where he would be pushing at this juncture. But of course, you know, we've got a lot of politics, a lot of geopolitics, a lot of geosecurity and geoeconomics to take place before the whole situation becomes absolute crystal clear. At this juncture, Paul, let's look at the advent, if we want to put that, the beginning of a burgeoning bipolarity in the world. And can you define that? And then we'll come back once that's defined and apply it to this current situation. We have in part already, but we'll dig deeper into what that means perhaps going forward 6 months from now, 18 months from now, if that momentum of bipolarity continues.
Sure, I'd be happy to. And again, another brief history lesson is appropriate. So we remember the Cold War as a clash or a confrontation between two superpowers and their respective alliance systems, which made for a bipolar world order. There was the US-led West, primarily centered around NATO and NATO alliances. And then there was the Soviet Union and its various allies, loosely connected to the People's Republic and other leftist movements throughout the world. The truth about the Cold War, the hard truth, is that it was never about democracy and communism. Okay, that was the ideological cloaking that was given to what essentially was a struggle between capitalism and what were known then as command economies. So they weren't market economies. They were economies that were led by the governments of the day. But remember, during the Cold War, the United States supported capitalist dictators all over the place. Murderous dictators like the Shah. My personal experience is with the Latin American dictators. Democracy was a very secondary concern. Conversely, the Soviet Union had good relations with, for example, the Swedes, who were social democratic within the confines of Europe, with the Indians, who from time to time would move in a left direction. The point was they were not completely wedded to the idea that you have to be a communist in order to be an ally. And so that bipolarity had a lot of fiction written into it. This emerging bipolarity is a true division between dictatorship and democracy. This is absolute. And the reason for that is mostly lies in democracy's failures over time. I hate to say it. You know, I've been someone who has written in quite a bit about democratization and those sort of things. Liberal democracy has become sclerotic. It's rife with corruption. It doesn't deliver. You know, you think of income inequalities and whatnot throughout the Western liberal democratic world. It's not a pretty picture. And it's become the moment of dictators to address the problems that democracy will not address of itself. And so the strongman politics have now emerged as a rival constellation to the decadent West, again, in their eyes. And so the countries that I mentioned, excuse me, that will support Russia in this are part of that constellation. But there are others who may remain neutral in this particular conflict. Let's say Turkey. Turkey's got its fingers in all sorts of pies, good relations with the Ukrainians, but good relations with the Russians. And it's geostrategically positioned, so it can't really make enemies out of either one of them. So, but it's run by a de facto dictator. Places like Brazil, nominally democratic, but run by a guy who has, if anything, dictatorial aspirations, and is right now talking about, since there will be elections later this year in Brazil that he may lose, he's already talking about election fraud. I mean, he's 9 months away, and he's saying they're going to steal it from me, but that's because he has no regard for democracy as a political form. He just wants to be a strongman, and so on and so forth. And of course, the most important of these dictatorships is the one-party authoritarian regime in the People's Republic of China. But let's remember, there are ones that do not receive international criticism, such as Singapore, another one-party dominant authoritarian regime that everybody likes, unless you're a dissident in Singapore. The Vietnamese are authoritarian, that they're the darlings of capitalism in Southeast Asia, and so on and so forth. So I think what we're seeing is, you mentioned it last week in a casual aside after the show, it's the new bipolarity. It's similar to, but different than what we saw during the Cold War. But this one, I think, is purer. This is a naked contest between the concept of democracy. I won't even say liberal democracy, but democracy as the political form versus authoritarianism. Would you rather the efficiency of the strongmen, or you would you not prefer, but can you live with the inefficiencies but representations, open representation of democracy?
So you know, let's take that question, that two-part question there. And if you were a loyal citizen of the Russian Federation, you don't want war. We saw a lot of news reports coming out overnight, particularly from the European press, and also Europe Radio, for example. Radio Free Europe, I should say. Sorry about that. They were down on the ground around where what the locals refer to as the gray zone, you know, and that's what we've been talking about in that area where the separatists are located and the Russian Federation troops are now asserting territory that is independent in its own right, and so occupying that under what it says is a peacekeeping maneuver. And Ukraine is saying, well, it's its territory and the clash is occurring. But getting back to that point, do you believe inside Russia that there are citizens in mass that would think, okay, we don't particularly like what is going to be happening by the look of it on our borders, but we still believe that war can be averted. And if war is not able to be stopped, well, then the West has some currency in the causes of that. And yeah, Putin is a strong man, but when we look toward where we were as children, we had stronger people with respect to taking people out, perhaps in our communities, our parents, etc., etc. We can live with Putin. Do you think, I suppose what I'm getting to is the question, do you think the populations inside these countries, these authoritarian regimes, will sustain the effort of these strong leaders? Or do you think that inside those countries there'll be fractures where it is unsustainable, it's not sustainable in the medium to long term?
Well, this is sort of the reason why I like talking with you, because it's a question that's not easy to answer. But let me start with the sort of counterfactual. So authoritarians, they guarantee you things. They guarantee you repression if you cross them. The harder they get, the more they can guarantee you death. They're all about, you know, promoting an image, again, of efficiency, of certainty, that they know what they're doing and they should not be crossed. The truth is exactly the opposite. Authoritarian regimes are far more arbitrary. Even if they're one party, they're institutionalized, they're far more arbitrary than democracy, simply because anything occurs at the whim of the authoritarian leadership. And if they change their minds from today to tomorrow about an issue of trade or a cultural issue, they impose it by force. You can't do that in democracies. You have to reach some sort of consensus for long-term viability of most policy decisions. On the other hand, and this is why this question is some complexity, you talk about the potential support, however grudgingly, of domestic populations for dictators. Now, I have to add a personal anecdote to all this, but I'll start with the research. There has now been done, for the last 15 years or so, a number of surveys about authoritarian regimes. It started out as a sort of boutique enterprise because 15 years ago, we had a lot more democracies in the world than we do today. And the polls basically were about, are people, are they a seething mass of would-be dissenters who are about to engage in revolution at any moment if you just uncork the bottle. And it turns out they're not. They're not. If the authoritarians deliver material goods, if the authoritarians are not overtly repressive of their people and are selective in their repression, they just go after dissidents.
The opposition.
What happened.
Yeah, yeah.
They have popular support. Singapore is the gold standard when it comes to authoritarianism of that sort. And here's my personal anecdote. As you well know, I grew up in Latin America, mostly under dictatorships, was involved in some subversion of my own back in the day. And the thing is this, before I became politicized, my family and I in Argentina in the mid 60s and whatnot, we went about our lives totally unencumbered by the fact that Argentina was ruled by a military junta. We played our sports, we had our picnics, even in the street, took the buses to and from school. There was nothing in our daily existence that suggested that we were oppressed. You had to raise your profile politically as an opponent to the regime to then get their attention. The worst violence I saw, again, until I became politicized, was in and around soccer stadiums between the fans of various teams, because soccer is, you know. And so my point is this, long-winded as it has been made, many dictatorships have popular support. They have popular support from the majority in some instances. They have to deliver the goods. And that's the key, is that they are more fragile because they have to deliver. You know, no one's going to wait. And then repression obeys a form of Newtonian law. It wanes over time if it's the sole thing keeping the regime up. You cannot repress the same amount of people forever. You cannot repress increasing amounts of people in the same measure for any length of time. And so authoritarians, once they see signs of defense, that's where the carrot is withdrawn and the stick comes out. There's only so many people you can beat with a stick before they realize they have nothing left to lose. And that's Putin's conundrum. The Russian economy is not doing that well. It turns out, reports are that Russians are not entirely down with this venture into the Ukraine because of the pressing socioeconomic problems at home. And so he's got to win this. He's absolutely got to win this, because if he gets bogged down, if the sanctions begin to bite, and not bite on him and his entourage, you know, he'll be isolated from the adverse effects. But if it starts biting Russian society, because what turns out to be a misadventure, invading a sovereign country, his position will be at risk. The knives will come out within his own party, and then in society as a whole. And if Russian soldiers die in large numbers, it may not have the dramatic impact that has had on the United States over the years with its various wars of opportunity, because this is a war of opportunity. Again, we're talking theoretically. There are wars of necessity and there are wars of opportunity. He's trying to portray this as a war of necessity. It is not. It is clearly a war of opportunity. People get very upset when wars of opportunity lead to the loss of lives of their co-specifics, their co-nationals. A war of necessity is like World War II. You don't care how many people, millions of people in the case of the Soviet Union, die, so long as you get the enemy out. And so this is not the siege of Stalingrad. This is not World War II. Again, trying to portray Ukraine as, you know, a dagger pointed at the underbelly of Mother Russia, I think is it's a florid way of characterizing things, but it simply is not true. And so there are risks for Putin, but he's aided and abetted by other dictatorial regimes. And so I think what we're seeing in terms of the broad picture, which we have alluded to, but I think now is becoming crystal clear as a result of this venture, is the world being divided not into capitalist and communist, but into democracies and dictatorships. And the balance of power between them still leans in the direction of democracy. But that tilt is slowly coming back towards the dictatorial side because, among other things, people who now live in Western liberal democracies are not happy with them. And so they're now considering what used to be unimaginable, which is a move to strongman politics, where the democratic privileges or niceties that they have gotten used to over generations are discarded in favor of a harder approach towards ruling. And again, where you see that clearly is in the Trump approach to democratic politics, and he's aided and abetted by a legion of politicians and media types, but he's not the only one. I mean, Erdogan is enough. Viktor Orban, there's a guy. Hungary is a NATO member, and yet its president says he will not condemn the Russians for invading the Ukraine. It's because his vision of democracy is a very narrow one. It excludes immigrants, it excludes gays, it excludes, you know, many things, minority religions. So Trump is not, he may be the leader of that pack. I call them the authoritarians from within, authoritarians emerging from within democratic countries. And then they are joined or they associate themselves with true dictatorships like Putin, like the Chinese, you know, places that have never really been democratic or democratic in name only. And that association, that alliance system is growing, not diminishing, whereas the democratic alliance system is diminishing rather than growing. That doesn't augur well for the likes of you and me, who happen to have an ideological preference for open governments and free thought. But that could well be the wave of the future. And I won't say in large part it will be determined by the outcome of the Russian-Ukrainian crisis, but it will tell us a lot once we see the resolution of this crisis about where the world is headed.
Well, thank you for that, Paul. That's crystal clear. And it also seems to be that the world has crossed a line of where we were in the post-Cold War period into this new period that we're talking about here with bipolarity and however it's defined. And thank you for defining that, Paul, between democracy and authoritarian dictatorships around the world. And it'll be interesting to see those fault lines where they clash. And I think one of the areas of comparative examples of where you can identify it may be in the UN General Assembly. If we saw that with the old Cold War and the clashes that took place there, there's some very obvious stances that are taken by both sides, and that'll be a thing to watch. And secondly, obviously, by the actions that are taken by all sides in this most dangerous and frightening thing for so many millions of people. Until next week, thank you for those that attended the live recording of this podcast, and also for those that are going to be listening to it once it's up later today. And I want to thank those that have been taking place. We've got some feedback that came in. They're very good talk. Thanks coming in from Paul H. No relation to Paul Buchanan. And so until next week, thank you again for your company. We look forward to your company again. Once again, it'll be New Zealand, Thursday, midday New Zealand time. And it'll be in the evening on Wednesday evening with respect to the United States Eastern. So take care, and we look forward to seeing you again then. Bye for now.